the International Court of Justice rules against Israel.
Israel must immediately halt its military offense.
Plus, a look at Israeli public opinion.
First, the major constant feature in Israeli public opinion for months is that more than 70% of the public wants to have early elections and thinks the prime minister should take responsibility and resign.
And later, Kenya's president is visiting Washington. What does that tell us about American plans regarding the continent? Ukraine has upgraded its sea drones, and a piece of Norway deep in the Arctic is for sale. But the buyer is making Oslo nervous. Today is Friday, May 24th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A developing story up top today. Judges at the International Court of Justice on Friday have ordered Israel to halt its military assault on the southern Gaza city of Rafah. Nawaf Salam is the presiding judge.
The court considered that, in conformity with its obligations under the Genocide Convention, Israel must immediately halt its military offensive and any other action in the Rafah governorate which may inflict on the Palestinian group in Gaza conditions of life that could bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part.
The court has also ordered Israel to open the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza to allow in humanitarian aid and said it must provide access for investigators. As of this recording, there has been no official reaction from the Israeli government. The order was adopted by a panel of 15 judges from around the world in a 13-2 vote, opposed only by judges from Uganda and from Israel itself. We'll find out what moved the Israeli government to reopen negotiations with Hamas in just a moment. First, though, some devastating news from the Indo-Pacific.
As you can see, this is destruction, natural catastrophe that took place last night at 3 o'clock a.m. in the morning. Everyone were fast asleep, not knowing that anything could take place, and they were fast asleep, and all of a sudden, natural catastrophe took place, and the place was covered by rocks, as you can see there. And from the information that I acquired from the people on the ground, they've just said that more than 300 lives have confirmed covered by the debris and rocks here right now. As you can see right at the back, people are crying and yawning, and people are very mourning for the lives that have been lost.
That's Andrew Ruing. He's a community leader in Mayap Mulitaka in northern Papua New Guinea, where hundreds are feared dead after a massive landslide flattened dozens of homes and buried entire families alive early on Friday. People can be seen carrying their belongings in bags over their heads as they walked over rocks and debris. And now back to the Middle East, where Israel's government has authorized efforts to renew talks with Hamas. This after families of some of the hostages seized on October 7th have shared previously unseen video of young female soldiers being abducted in hopes of pushing the government to bring their loved ones home. Reuters' Diane Toe has the story.
Israeli television aired footage on Wednesday of five female army conscripts in their pajamas being seized by Hamas gunmen during the October 7th raid that triggered the Gaza war. The captives' families agreed to air the previously withheld clips in hope of stepping up pressure on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to agree a truce with Hamas and secure the hostages' release. Among the conscripts is 19-year-old Nama Levy, seen here with her face bloodied, speaking to her captors. The gunmen order Levy and her group to sit against a wall, their hands bound.
Number again.
Some of the clips show exchanges in English. In one, a militant is heard calling the female captives the cheap ones in Arabic, while another tells a captive she is beautiful. The young women are later shown being bundled into jeeps and taken away.
Very hard, emotionally.
Levy's brother Amit told Reuters the videos were tough to watch.
But I also, watching my little sister handle such an inhuman situation in such a way, she really looks like a superhero to me. And it also gives me and my whole family strength to see her this way, to see the other girls this way. But I know that her time is running out, and a deal needs to happen soon.
He and relatives of other hostages traveled to London, where they showed Britain's Deputy Prime Minister the video and lobbied for support to bring home their loved ones.
It feels like more than ever, things are getting a bit further away. The world forgets. Also, maybe the Israeli government needs a reminder of what's the most important thing right now.
Levy is part of the Hostages' Families Forum, which represents relatives of the 124 people, mostly civilians, believed to still be held by Hamas. The group said the footage came from body cams worn by gunmen who attacked the army base in southern Israel, where the women served as surveillance spotters. In a statement, it said, quote, "The Israeli government must not waste another moment. It must return to the negotiating table today." Within hours of its release, Netanyahu's security cabinet convened and authorized an effort to renew the talks, according to an Israeli official. The government also saw the release of the video as an opportunity to shore up support. A spokesperson told reporters, quote, "Watch the film, support Israel in bringing our people home." Hamas called it a bid to manipulate public opinion and said the female soldiers were treated according to the ethics of their resistance. Israel's foreign ministry said it would show the video to the ambassadors of Ireland, Norway and Spain. The ministry had summoned them to protest their government's plans to recognize a Palestinian state.
That's Diane Toe of Reuters reporting for us. And as we've heard earlier, the ICJ ruled against Israel earlier on Friday. The prosecutor at the ICC wants to arrest Israel's prime minister and defense minister. And three more European countries will recognize a Palestinian state over Tel Aviv and Washington's objections. So in a week where Israel appears to be facing near global condemnation, what does the Israeli public think? To find out, I spoke with Nimrod Goren. He's a senior fellow for Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute. He says that most Israelis aren't happy about what's going on, but the unhappiness is directed at Israel's leadership.
First, the major constant feature in Israeli public opinion for months is that more than 70% of the public wants to have early elections and thinks the prime minister should take responsibility and resign. And that's something that we didn't typically have in Israeli politics. And many of the events that are ongoing, and we had quite a number of dramatic such events this week, are being assessed by the public through that prism of a leadership that does not deliver. And one of the things that were evident this week is that the leadership does not deliver only on achieving the war objectives, but also on issues relating to diplomacy and Israel's global standing, which really suffered a blow. The decision this week was something that Israelis could not really understand how it could be that Hamas leaders and the prime minister and the minister of defense are all mentioned in the same package with all their arrest warrants. It's so far away from how Israeli perceives their positions, their status, the prime minister, even if objecting to him politically. So it was incomprehensible by the vast majority of the Israeli public.
And would you say it's a similar feeling to the statement from the three European countries recognizing the Palestinian state?
Yes, but on a different intensity. I think the practical meaning of the ICC decision, and today we have another discussion with the ICJ, so all these international legal aspects bring Israel into some sort of a new territory with consequences that could have implications not only on those who are currently maybe being issued the warrants, but also on others, maybe some of the people fighting today in Rafah. We don't know. On the recognition of the Palestinian state, that's something that is more familiar. After all, there are more than around 140 countries that have already recognized the Palestinian state, including some countries in Europe. So it's not totally new. It's seen mostly a symbolic step that represents, you know, how the international community views the end game of the war in Gaza and the conflict with the Palestinians. It doesn't have much practical aspects, but it does cause tensions and shows the difference between the Israeli position, this is the official ones, and growing consensus within the international community.
So going back to what you said earlier about how Israelis are viewing what's going on through the prism of a displeasure with the Netanyahu government, are you saying that there are Israelis who are blaming this international condemnation on Netanyahu for doing the wrong things, instead of viewing the international condemnation as sort of an anti-Israel, anti-Semitic sentiment in the world?
I think for many Israelis, it will be both. So, of course, when you talk about 70% of Israelis, you have within that all kind of ideological positions and different motivations. Some are ideologically opposed to the way of Netanyahu. Some are within his political camp but think he's soft, he's too soft on the Palestinians. So there's really a big variety. There is a very significant part of Israelis that view all these international actions as inherent anti-Israeli positions or anti-Semitism, or each one will call it something different. But the fact that the Israel leadership has not managed this almost 8 months of war in a way that reached the objectives, the war is prolonging, international support is going down, American pressure is increasing, tensions with allies is on the rise. It seems like the leadership is not navigating this whole situation into the best place for Israel's national security. And you have military officials, Israeli ones, going on record saying that the lack of strategy for a day after the war or lack of diplomatic planning basically enables or leads the IDF, the Israeli military, to lose all of those achievements that it got on the battlefield over the last month, and it needs to go back and back again to the same places in Gaza and fight again without really making something new come out of it in terms of new regional realities, new governance in Gaza, etc.
So what happens next?
The Israeli parliament came back this week from its recess and will be working for the next 2+ months. And I think what happens next will be movements within the Israeli political space towards early elections. We already heard Benny Gantz, who is leading a centrist party that is in opposition to Netanyahu, but part of the war cabinet, that threatens that if within three weeks, Netanyahu will not change his policy, will not adopt a different strategy for ending the war, then his party will pull out and resign. And that could spark some chain reaction that eventually what Israelis want to see is by end of July, when the Knesset goes to another recess, that early elections will be called. And I think that's where change can come from, because this type or another of international pressure can move Netanyahu quite on symbolic or small-scale issues. The big picture is that the current Israeli coalition, which is a far-right one, is not interested in ending this war or in making progress towards a two-state solution. Even if the American administration is putting an offer in return for normalization with Saudi Arabia, which is something that Israel wants for decades. And in order to change that, you need a different type of coalition, and you get that through elections. So it's becoming a domestic political issue, and the sense of urgency for change is becoming more evident, I think, to more and more people.
Nimrod Gorn is a senior fellow for Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute. Mr. Gorn, thank you for your analysis on the subject.
Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, in the United States, President Joe Biden hosted Kenyan President William Ruto for a state dinner. But more importantly, Biden announced that he would make Kenya a major non-NATO ally. The move signals the shifting of U.S. security cooperation to East Africa, just as U.S. troops prepare to depart Niger. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
As President Joe Biden welcomed Kenyan President William Ruto to the White House Thursday for the first state visit by an African leader in nearly 16 years, he topped the soft power festivities, which included a lavish state dinner, with something much more concrete. Biden announced he'd recognize Kenya as a major non-NATO ally, a status that gives it privileged access to U.S. training and equipment.
That's a fulfillment of years of collaboration. Our joint counterterrorism operations have degraded ISIS and al-Shabaab across East Africa. Our mutual support for Ukraine has rallied the world to stand behind the UN Charter. And our work together on Haiti is helping pave the way to reduce instability and insecurity.
And Ruto reiterated his plea that the U.S. double its commitments to help restructure African nations' debts, most of which are to the world's largest creditor, China.
Unless this is done, and done immediately, the values of freedom, democracy, and the rule of law are in great jeopardy.
Analysts say Kenya's spotty human rights record, as documented by the U.S. State Department, raises concerns about how it will use its new privileged status. Michael Walsh is a senior fellow in the Africa program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and a visiting scholar at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of California, Berkeley.
Kenya has serious issues with things like extrajudicial killings and forced disappearances and torture and cruel and inhumane and other forms of degrading punishment by government or by or on behalf of the government. And this is by the security forces. So there's going to be concerns that that part of the strategy is being abandoned, that the U.S. is no longer putting such a priority on democracy promotion in Africa, and the U.S. is really retrenching towards the security side of the security democracy paradigm.
Ruto also ironed out a number of other agreements during his day-long deliberations in Washington and discussed Kenya's delayed plans to send 1,000 security officers to the Caribbean nation of Haiti. The initiative, toward which the U.S. has pledged $300 million, faces stiff political and legal challenges in Kenya, and has been delayed by political turmoil in Haiti. Ruto, who said he was looking forward to the deployment of forces to Haiti, did not give a date. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Violence is ratcheting up in Myanmar. We'll have that story shortly. Now for an update on the war in Ukraine, where we learned about a new advancement in sea drones. For more, I'm joined by Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
These drones are called Sea Baby. And just this week, it was confirmed personally by the head of the Ukrainian Security Service that actually Ukrainian forces made certain upgrade. Ukrainian forces installed multiple rocket launchers on top of these Sea Baby drones. And according to the head of the Ukrainian Security Service, they already were in action at least four times, and at least four Russian ships were hit by those systems from the drones. And basically, with thanks to these drones, Ukrainian army managed to create a lot of trouble for the Russian Black Sea fleet.
So enhanced sea drones in the Black Sea, that's going to be in the south of Ukraine. It's a different story in the east and in the north. Can you tell us what's happening there?
At this point, what we see that a situation in the eastern front line, we're talking here about Donetsk region mainly, it remains tough. However, the hottest spot is still in the Kharkiv region, which is east-north. And Russian forces continue to basically, what they're doing is they continue to create this buffer zone on the territory of Ukraine. At least this is how it looks. Russian forces continue the shelling of the city of Kharkiv and the surroundings, the area next to the city and close to the Russian border. Also, there is a danger for Sumy region also on the border with Russia. And according to President Zelensky and also according to Ukrainian military, a lot of action is happening there as well, particularly the shelling of the territory. And also, it was just announced a couple of days ago that intensified fortification fortification construction is ongoing because Sumy region can also, basically can repeat the destiny of Kharkiv region, because if Russian forces have this goal of creating a buffer zone, then it would be quite logical that they will try to also use Sumy region for this purpose.
It's VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
On Friday, the United Nations Human Rights Office warned there's a risk of a serious rise in violence in Myanmar's Rakhine State, where it received frightening and disturbing reports of the killing of Rohingya people and burning of their property. Elizabeth Throssell is the spokesperson for the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, or the OHCHR.
We are receiving frightening and disturbing reports from northern Rakhine State in Myanmar of the impacts of the conflict on civilian lives and property. Some of the most serious allegations concern incidents of killing of Rohingya civilians and the burning of their property. Tens of thousands of civilians have been displaced in recent days by the fighting in Butidaung and Mangdao townships. an estimated 45,000 Rohingya have reportedly fled to an area on the Naf River near the border with Bangladesh, seeking protection.
The Rohingya have faced persecution in Buddhist-majority Myanmar for decades. After escaping a military-led crackdown in 2017, nearly a million have crammed into refugee camps in Bangladesh's border district of Cox's Bazar. Land in the northern Norwegian islands of Svalbard is being auctioned off by its owner with strong interest from Chinese buyers. Such a sale would likely cause geopolitical headaches for Norway and NATO because of Svalbard's strategic location in the Arctic Ocean. Henry Wilkins has the story.
The archipelago of Svalbard lies about 650 kilometers off the Norwegian mainland in a geopolitical hotspot in the high Arctic. An international treaty gives Svalbard an unusual legal structure that bans most military activity. But in recent years, that hasn't stopped countries, particularly Russia and Norway, from pursuing strategic aims. Now China may enter the mix. That's because in early May, a private owner put a 60 square kilometer stretch of land on the market for $326 million. And a lawyer in charge of the sale, Per Killingstad, says there is a concrete interest from Chinese buyers. Analysts say Norway would not support the sale to a Chinese buyer. Norway has said the sale requires its approval. Killingstad denies that.
This is not correct, 100% not correct. Got a legal opinion prior to some time ago, also from one of the largest law firms in Oslo, on this, and it's absolutely clear.
The Norwegian Minister of Trade, Industry and Fisheries told VOA in a statement via email, "We do not agree with the lawyer responsible for the sale. There is also no permission to initiate negotiations regarding the transfer of the property without the consent from the Ministry of Trade, Industry and Fisheries." Killingstad says he is pushing ahead with the auction. One analyst told VOA why the Norwegian government might be looking to intervene in the sale.
Obviously, the Arctic itself is getting a lot more international attention because of security concerns. There is a lot of worry that the Arctic is going to see quite a bit of spillover between the obviously worsened relations between the West and Russia. So the timing for this is rather distinct.
Analysts say China is interested in the Arctic to gain access to untapped natural resources, advantageous military positioning, and newly established shipping routes created by sea ice melt. Some experts have pointed out that the land being sold on Svalbard is designated as a national park. Driving a snowmobile across it would likely be illegal, so any uses of the land for a potential buyer beyond research would be problematic. But Killingstad says buyers are focused on the long-term benefits of owning the land.
They are looking at this in a long-term horizon to get a foothold in the Arctic and are not necessarily looking into what they can do up there during the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, maybe 30 years, 50 years, maybe 100 years, because this is the only opportunity you would have to get to acquire land in the so-called high Arctic.
Killingstad said the seller, which local media say is a company owned by a Russian-born Norwegian, was not concerned about selling to countries like China, which have poor human rights records. He pointed out that philanthropists might just as easily buy the land. But ultimately, Killingstad said the land will be sold to the highest bidder. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.